Hi, this is Mike Hines. You're listening to Teaching to Meet the Moment from the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching here at Stanford University. Our first season revolves around how we adapt to the current moment, not simply to make it through, but to reimagine what education looks like, build community, and continue to advance our values, even under circumstances that are far from ideal. In today's episode, Staying True to Our Values, we talk with doctoral student and researcher Jessica Lee Stovall and practitioners Amy Rieth and Margaret Ramsey about how different educators are going through the process of identifying and reaffirming those values for themselves.
Welcome, everybody. This is a really exciting opportunity for us here at the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching, also known as CSET. We're housed at Stanford University, and we've got a couple of guests here and co-hosts from Stanford, as well as some practitioners from the field. This is our inaugural episode of our inaugural podcast, and I'm Nicole Luciani Elliott. I taught school for 20 years, social studies and English, and I'm currently the assistant director for CSET, where my work focuses on equitable instruction, particularly in history social studies classrooms.
And I'm Mike Hines. I'm a former social studies and ELA teacher, currently an assistant professor here at the Stanford Graduate School of Education, and my work centers on the history of America's schools.
So we spent some time this fall thinking about how do we create a space for teachers to come together in community, because I think a lot of us are feeling isolated and lonely and malnourished, quite frankly. The work of education has arguably never been harder. And over the past year, the global pandemic has shaken the core of public education and what it even means to be a teacher here in this country, and I would probably guess internationally as well. In addition, we continue to see deeply entrenched legacies of structural and systemic racism and massive inequalities in our schools that distance learning has just magnified more than ever before. The trends that this pandemic has not so much revealed as maybe unveiled are heightened and highlighted for us as educators. And this not even to speak of the chaos and instability that's taken hold in our government right now. We are a community arguably in some level of crisis, every one of us. And so as we started to grapple and think through all of this, our wondering was really, how do we think about creating a space that would allow us to talk to practitioners and the things that they care about that are taking place in our world right now? Our goal is not at all to position ourselves as experts, but inquirers, asking educators what this moment means for teachers, schools, and students. Our intention is to normalize vulnerability, invite curiosity, and encourage conversation.
So this is our first episode. We ask you to really have some grace with us when we make mistakes. We have 10 really great episodes on tap for season one. So please continue to join us in the coming weeks as this work evolves, much like it does for all of you in your classrooms around the country. We really can't thank you enough for sharing your precious time with us tonight. We're calling episode one, Staying True to Our Values. The pandemic and the political strife of the last year, not to mention the last week, has really forced teachers around the country to reflect on what drives them to do the work that they do, whether that's a commitment to racial justice, to building communities of care within their classrooms, or to fostering civic engagement and democratic action.
We're all trying to do this work in what can easily be seen as the triple pandemic of health, racism, and political instability of the highest order. So the real question for us is, how do we stay true to our values when sometimes we frankly can barely get out of bed in the morning, when there's so much work to do to serve our kids and we barely know even where to start, when things continue to change in a moment's notice and the lesson plan that we've already revised three times now has to be thrown away altogether. When someone we love, or maybe even we ourselves get sick, if we have children at home, the stressors are unprecedented. And so what we wanted to talk about today is, how do we stay true to our values in the sea of all of these challenges. And we've invited some guests here today to have this conversation with us. And we hope to all be really thinking about learning together. These three guests will start. I'll start by introducing Jessica Stovall. Jessica is a doctoral student in the program of Race, Inequality, and Language in Education here at Stanford. She's a recipient of a Fulbright Distinguished Award in Teaching Grant, the Stanford Enhancing Diversity in Graduate Education Fellowship, and the Ford Foundation Pre-Doctoral Fellowship. She's pretty much a badass, is what we would say. Her current research explores Black teacher retention, examining how discourses of storytelling and ratification in Black teacher affinity groups reverse Black teacher attrition. And before she joined us here at Stanford, she taught English for 11 years at Oak Park River Forest High School in Oak Park, Illinois. Welcome to Jessie. Next, we have Amy. Amy was born and raised outside of Chicago by parents from Montgomery, Alabama. Amy has been a passionate advocate and educator of young minds for 22 years, currently teaching English at Buffalo Grove High School outside of Chicago. Amy sponsors the Ebony Club, which serves as a way to create a familial atmosphere for growth, guidance, and community for African-American students in predominantly white spaces. And finally, we have Margaret Ramsey. Margaret is an upper school English teacher at the Menlo School here in the Bay Area of California, where she also serves as the new faculty coach and the interim English chair. Margaret has worked in independent schools since 2008, and her work includes a dedication to diversity, equity, and inclusion, informed pedagogy, and supporting students as they tell their stories. So to each of you for joining us today, thank you all so much for being here. We're so grateful that you've joined us on Teaching to Meet the Moment.
So I'll take over. I'll jump right in, actually, because we want as much time for this conversation as possible. We want to hear as much from you as possible. Our first question really is a two-parter. The first part is, what are the values that you found crucial or critical to your work as an educator before all the turmoil of the last year? And then, to what extent have recent events led you to rethink, shift, or realign those values?
This is Jessica. I can jump right in. So before the pandemic, the main driving purpose for me in doing this work was to eliminate racial predictabilities of student academic achievement. I wanted it to be so that when anyone walked into my classroom, you could not predict based on race how anyone would be doing academically, social emotionally, behaviorally. And that was really important to me. It's inspired by my own experiences growing up in schools. It was inspired by my students who were fighting against racial inequities and systemic racism. And I just really wanted that to be my purpose. And so a lot of the dedication when I was teaching outside of Chicago was doing that work. And I went on national TV and told that story. I did a Fulbright and told that story, but I kept finding that the more that I spoke out, the more that I used my voice, the more that I felt very silenced. And it was frustrating, and it made me start to lose myself as I kind of got caught up in that. And so when I decided to pursue a doctorate, I really had to think very hard about the kind of researcher I wanted to be. And the pandemic has really kind of helped me shift some of that thinking, because I could be a researcher that is has a voice of criticism, right? So I could be looking at what's wrong in the educational system, which we know that there's piles and piles of things. Or I could be a voice of hope. I could be looking for what is going right in the education system. And after looking at what's happening in the pandemic, as we teachers, we have 2.3 million teachers and public school teachers and 500,000 private school teachers. And from every angle, teachers are just being dragged in the media. And so one thing for me was, I know teachers that are doing incredible things. And so that's why I'm working with the Black Teacher Project that's based out of Oakland, but making its way across the United States, providing really amazing Black affinity spaces for teachers to come together, community. I want to tell those stories of resistance. I want to tell the stories of teachers doing amazing things in the face of incredible odds, as you were saying earlier, Nicole, right? This is an unprecedented time and teachers are doing remarkable things. And so I didn't want to be another voice that is criticizing what's happening. I wanted to really tell the story of the people and communities that are doing remarkable things. So the pandemic is really made that very clear, that if I really want to walk in my purpose and my value of doing this work, it is, in my opinion, way harder to tell the story of what's going right than it is just to point out what's going wrong. So that for me has been made really clear from the pandemic.
Amy, go ahead.
Oh, sure. So what's been crucial for me, and this is before the pandemic, you know, I always quote my mom, Cleona Rel, you can't have courageous conversations with folks who ain't courageous. Mm. So I've always, you know, started and led my classroom with the intention about racial justice and trying to educate others about how the system is flawed. I mean, we have to start there. What's wrong? And we go from there in my classroom. What I've done since the pandemic is trying to hold my administrators accountable for their lack of listening to what I've been saying before the pandemic, and how we can move forward by doing their own education, but also centering my voice. Mm. I often find when I'm bringing up issues of racial injustices, they always have this epiphany, like, oh my goodness, you know, this is happening. I have the answer and my voice is left out. And so I've been making an effort, intentional effort, to always center my voice and always center Black, Indigenous, and people of color voices. I am one of two Black teachers in my school. And before that, I was the onlyest one. And I know English teachers are cringing, but I was the onlyest one. And it was hard. It was very hard. And, you know, the trauma I experienced. And now it's time for self-healing.
Thank you.
The question.
You did. Yeah. I heard courage is a core value loud and clear, Amy.
Mm-hmm. So this is Margaret. And as an English teacher, I love the word onlyest. It's so delightful. It's fantastic. I really appreciate this question. When I heard it, my first thoughts go to the two values that I find myself kind of repeating to myself as a mantra over and over again. I find myself really needing to like take a beat when I start to get overwhelmed. And so these are the things I keep reminding myself as my touch points. And I think that my answer is a bit more informed by sort of like how I'm centering my classroom teacher self. And in my role too, also being somebody who is responsible for helping my colleagues and the other adults in our community relate to their students. So that's where I'm coming from. And the two things that I keep coming back to that were important to me before, but are essential to me now. The first is just to lead with relational curiosity. And what I mean by that, what that means to me is that I think we talk a big game as educators about relationships, right? Like really making sure that we're getting to know our kids and that we're wondering about them and hearing their stories. But I would offer that I think that comes with a decent amount of potential bias and a lot of blind spots. Right. So when I'm saying relational curiosity, something that I think has saved me and has really helped my fellow colleagues this year is to recall that we don't know what we don't know. And to just, you know, if somebody's, hey, I'm not, my camera's off, don't fill in that narrative, right? Like take a beat back, take a moment, ask that question, hey, what's up with you? How can I help you? And I think that this, you know, what both Amy and Jessica were saying, the pandemic is not necessarily it's creating its own new problems, but certainly just revealing in a more front and center way challenges and issues that were always there that I think we were, you know, again, like perhaps our relational curiosity wasn't there enough to truly care, to truly wonder and not fill in a blank. Oh, that kid's late because, oh, that kid hasn't done their work because, oh, you know what, the parents must feel this because, oh, you know what, like, this is good. And so, right, I think we're really in our spaces now where if we're not curious about truly wondering with compassion and sort of like unconditional positive regard, like, hey, what happened? Like, I'm truly curious. I really want to know. We're completely lost. And so for me, giving really the primacy of both your time and your energy to that kind of a mindset has been a game changer for the classroom and for how we're all relating and working together. And the second value is just in terms of education, just making your content exploratory and really giving, you know, enough guidance and space for kids to feel, students of all ages, to feel that perplexity, to feel that curiosity, to think, oh, like, that's kind of a cool thing. But meanwhile, kind of balancing that with the experience of getting out of their way so that they can show you their creativity, so that they can like kind of join in and co-create that space. Because, you know, a bad lesson's a bad lesson, but nothing like a bad lesson on Zoom. I mean, that is, that's really brutal for everybody's feelings. And so just make it exploratory, make it exploratory has been a huge guiding light for me.
Guys, thanks for all of those answers. I really loved, Jesse, what you were saying about sort of acknowledging the inequities that we're dealing with, but not stopping there. And I think Amy, mm-hmm. you also said that as well, right? That we acknowledge those inequities, but we don't let those inequities or those critiques be where we stop, right? We instead choose to center voices that haven't been heard, and we tell those stories of hope, and we tell those stories of resistance, and we pick up and we work from there. And then I really love this last point about valuing relationships and coming to relationships with curiosity and with openness. I guess it sort of leads into a second question.
Oh, Mike, do you mind if I interrupt you? I wanted to follow up on something that Amy said, because I feel like there's a piece there that might be helpful to our teachers in the audience. Do you mind mm-hmm. if I interrupt you just to follow
absolutely.
Up? Amy, I think you made a very important point about our power to push back, especially in the context of, you know, I don't want to blanket the whole, all of us who look like me who are white, but the whole notion of like, I'm so shocked this is happening. And really, like, where's the shock for folks who've been living with this forever? And so this idea of centering your voice and the other folks who are Black and Indigenous folks in your community, and you mentioned pushing back, and I'm wondering if you can give any guidance to what that looks like, how to kind of get your courage up to do those things. Because I think there's a lot of us who are working under circumstances that are completely misaligned with our values. And part of it has to do with leadership. And so how do we have those conversations? I know this is a giant question, but I'm wondering if you just have like 30 seconds, you could give us some guidance.
You'll have to read Amy Ralph, Pushing Back. Applying okay. Pressure, the memoir, like okay. that. I've been pushing back. I came from a family of people who apply pressure and push back. I come from a family of freedom fighters from Montgomery, Alabama. So this is in my blood. This is me. And I owe this all to my ancestors and the people before me. But, you know, it started with me being like the onlyest one doing it. And then I asked my allies and my friends to join with me. And I've gone so many different routes. I've done it by myself. I've included people of color. I started in my district that one of the founders of the African American leadership team. And we are the consciousness or the conscious of the district. We're always pushing back to against administration and our superintendent. And then I was able to join the justice group in our district. And then I was, you know, after a while, you know, you get tired. Fatigue sets in. So mm-hmm. I have my white colleagues and I use them as a voice. But I'm always pushing back. I'm sending an email. I'm sending a text. Mm-hmm. I'm doing something. I'm relying on students to also push back and teach mm-hmm. them how to be a voice. But you know, it's so surprising to me in 2020, 2021 now, we still have white folks who have these basic revelations about racism. And it's like, really, you know, and what I've encouraged my administrators to do, they need to hire an anti-racist coach. Mm. We have all these different other kind of coaches, a tech coach, this coach, a literacy coach. Get you an anti-racist coach. Mm. If you want to be a leader and you want to protect Black, Indigenous, and people of color in this building, staff and students, you need to get help. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so my mouth is my way of pushing back.
Thank you for that. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, I think we've seen so many of those kind of frustrating revelations that people are coming to about race, especially in the last week or so. I think it's important to acknowledge that we have a long, long way to go on that. So we've talked a little bit about your values and what grounds you in the work that you do. I'm wondering, sort of as a next question that we could take up, how each of you have sort of adapted to make sure that you continue to be able to embody those values, even as we're sort of physically separated from students and from families and communities. Any advice for teachers who are working at a distance right now, whether that's, you know, in the higher ed like us or in K-12, in terms of how to embody those values even online?
Margaret, let's start with you this time.
Sure, yeah. I think for me, the biggest shift in terms of working towards embodying those values has been really taking into account, thinking about my students' psychological safety in the space of a Zoom environment, especially, you know, I think it's one thing when we kind of can think about the psychological safety of a kid in any given building, right? And, you know, like just like Amy's saying, like those buildings can be challenging, right? Like sometimes those buildings are not welcoming spaces. You're not excited to go to school. And in fact, working from home is feeling a lot better. You're feeling much freer. You're feeling much more creative, right? And for other kids, of course, on the other end of the spectrum, it's feeling really isolating or exhausting or just feeling constantly monitored, right, by being watched, right? So there's so many different things going on for students that are just about their physical reality, physically showing up. So I think for me, again, you know, this is one of those things that was always in bold when you're thinking about your students, but it's in bold italics, like caps, when you're in this pandemic environment, that you have to think about their physical reality and their psychological safety. So a big change for me in my practice has been thinking about the variety of ways to use the various tools, like be that Nearpod or Pear Deck or, you know, different modalities of participation. You know, I don't necessarily need to see your face, or can I give kids some space just proactively so they, hey, if you're going to read over this slide deck for me, go ahead, turn your camera off. I'll call you back in 2 minutes. And just giving kids breaks and working on the nuance of that. So that's been a huge shift in terms of adaptation that I'm, you know, is it challenging? Absolutely. But I think it's so gratifying and I'm so much more aware and I feel really like it will help when we all come back into real, you know, sort of live classes. I'm grateful for the challenge, to be honest. It's really helped me.
That's great. Jessica, where do you stand with this whole thing? You are teaching courses literally as we speak.
Yeah, actually, I did pop out of a course I'm teaching pre-service English teachers right now, and I popped out of class to join you all today. One thing I've been thinking so much about is one of the big sickness and illness as a result of a racist system is that minoritized people are dehumanized, right? It's one of the first things that happens as a symptom of this very perverse system. And so a lot of my work before the pandemic was around how do I make sure that I'm centering the human? If that's the central, one of the central things that happens as a result of racism is the dehumanization. And during the pandemic, more than ever, this has become apparent, right? This idea need to bring the human back, kind of inspired like a little bit what Margaret was saying earlier The human needs to come back. Like, teachers are under incredible loads, right? This is one of the most challenging times, as you said, Nicole, to be teaching. And the pressures are huge, but we're also battling our own personal experiences with the pandemic, as well as Zoom fatigue. The students that are not on Zoom or not on videos, you don't know if they're okay all the time. The lack of responsiveness, the overwhelming emails, the double amount of prep it takes to be able to do lessons, right? It's a wild time. So with all of these things on our plates, it's very easy that the first thing that can go is the human. And so I think so much about designing my classes and how do I front and center, make sure that I'm hearing students' voices, that they're able to talk about their experiences, that they're able to express emotion, whether that is joy or sadness or anger or frustration, that they're able to connect with each other as they're so isolated and siloed, right? And so for me, I don't need to get through all the content. I really let a lot of that go, but I do need to make sure that my students are okay. And I believe in the beginning that students will not be academically successful if they're not social emotionally healthy. So I really have shifted my viewpoint a lot during the pandemic to making sure that I'm responsive, that the work I'm doing is culturally sustaining, that they're feeling supported emotionally to be able to show up to class. And then I'm doing all that I can to do that. And so that's something that's been really important to me, is just bringing back that humanizing pedagogy, bringing the human back into the classroom.
I really, really agree with what you just said as far as bringing the human side of teaching back, right? And nurturing our students as people first. And we might have to have you back in the future when we do episodes on community building specifically, and on strategies for how to keep that sense of community going, right? Mm-hmm. Even in this virtual environment, because I heard you say a lot of things about creating purposeful spaces, right, for your students to hear their voices and to allow them to talk to each other and talk to you. I think that's going to be really important moving forward.
Yeah, agreed. Amy, what thoughts do you have about this this question of how have you adapted?
I agree everything with Margaret and Jessica. And what I do every day, I try to find time to normalize joyful moments.
I love that.
Every day. That is my goal. You know, even with what happened last week with the domestic terrorists taking over the Capitol, like, I found some joy, not in that, but in something else. We celebrated, you know, the first Black and Jewish senator to be elected in Georgia. So that was our celebration. Mm-hmm. And we also celebrated the Black women behind men who were elected to Congress. Because a lot of spaces do not allow for joy. Mm-hmm. And so my classroom, I begin every class with music. I'm playing a Black, Indigenous, or a person of color artist, musical artist. And I also allow students to work in group PD, reading, and they must find joy in something. And at the beginning of class, they might not be able to locate that joyful moment, but toward the end, they're able to maybe, you know, find that joy in another student or in something that we learned about in class. So I'm just normalizing joy, because gotta keep it going.
Indeed, indeed. I love that you all have highlighted these values that are really important to you: courage, joy, community, even down, you know, the notion of nuance and continuing to be a learner. These are all values that you clearly all hold. And I wonder if we think about that enough, if we think about, as educators, what do I really value? And then the other question I wonder is if we really think about what our students value. And so I'm wondering, how are you enabling the values of your students to inform your work as a classroom teacher in this particular time? Amy, maybe we'll start with you this time.
Sure. So when I received this question, this one was one of the questions that really stuck with me. One reason is, you know, I'm a normalizing joy. That's my motto for as I enter the classroom. But I want to again find spaces that will uplift students, and at the bare minimum, listen to what they truly have to say. And sometimes, you know, you have to take attendance, you have to do this, you have to check all these boxes. And I'm guilty of missing some things that they maybe express on the chat, or they say it to me, or they sent in the email. So my a part of my value 2021 is to take time to listen and to affirm their voice. And let them know that their beliefs and what they believe in is valid, as long as they're making society better, you know, especially my students of color, constantly affirming their voice. I do an assignment with students and they have to turn them in at the end of the semester. And my division chair shared with the principal one of the essays that this student wrote. He was a Latinx student. And he said he didn't feel that he belonged in an AP class. And after taking my class, he felt that he could have taken an AP class, but this is his senior year. Mm-hmm. He said he was always taught to stay in his lane. Mm-hmm. And I gave him that hope and the belief that, hey, he doesn't have to continue to be this stereotypical, you know, Latinx male. He could go out of his lane using his words. He didn't have to stay in his lane, mm-hmm. out of his lane. So I don't know if I answered the question.
You did. Absolutely. You did. Yeah, I heard a lot about taking time to listen and validating and affirming who they are and what they have to say, as long as they're communicating or contributing to society. And this idea of, you know, allowing kids to step out of their lane. I mean, how many of us need that permission ourselves as adults to step out of our lane? Margaret, let's go to you. What are you doing to enable the values of our kids in your classrooms?
Yeah, I mean, I think I echo a lot of what Amy's saying. And I would say that now more than ever, I'm very aware, like I really think about, okay, you're a teacher and yes, you're teaching whatever your content is and that's fantastic. But at the end of the day, for me, that's like quite truly never what it's been about. It's about seeing our kids, seeing the next generation, encouraging them, helping them get to know themselves, sort of like reflected back from what you're able to see in them, right? Helping them be creative. And so for me this year, I've been really cognizant of thinking about, man, my job is showing a version of adulthood that looks joyful, that looks creative, that looks resilient, and that is hurting, that is sad, that is disgusted, right? Like with the events that I am constantly thinking, like it is part of my job to show up truly as an adult and show a version of adulthood that has multitudes, that does not necessarily only show up and say, hey, where's the homework? Mm-hmm. Oh, hey, like, you know, you hear, like, you know, whatever. So for myself and my colleagues that I work with, we've been saying to ourselves and giving ourselves that permission, exactly like you said, Nicole, to do less so that we can care more about what we are caring about. And kind of, I think we're flooded with things we could care about. I will admit, I have never once cared about Pear Deck before this year, right? Like, have not. And it's like, I could get really lost. I could be watching YouTubers of people being like fancier, more artistic, better educators than me. But I have to say, hey, you know what? Actually, I got to do less right now because that's not what it's about. Like, not a single kid cares about my Bitmoji classroom. Not one. So like, what I gotta do, they think I'm cheesy, they do not care, right? So like, what I have to do is do less so I can care more and create that space, right? I think we're like, we got an hour, how are we gonna, and I'm like, you know what, I'm gonna plan for 30 and see what happens, like, so that we can be present. And so I think that's a really big part of it, just kind of making sure that you're showing adulthood in its full range, being an ally, like Amy's saying, or being the voice that stands up. And to me, that's sort of like where teaching has had to take the primacy this year, like really holding that down. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
That's what's been guiding me.
Yes. I wrote down, do less so we can care more. I think that's it right there. Jessica, let's bring us home here. What are you doing to center the values of our kids in your classes? or I guess our adult teachers to be in your classes now?
Yeah, so I teach everything from undergrad all the way up. So feedback, it's really about feedback. If I'm gonna say that I care about my students' values, I care about their voices, I care about their passions, I need to be able to hear, internalize, and change based off of what they need. And so that means that every week I ask for what did I do well, or what did we do well, and what could be changed or improved, and what questions do you have? And each week, the next week I come in and I summarize the feedback of what went really well, and I highlight, usually it's just one thing that like, I'm gonna keep doing this. So many people liked walk and talks. We're gonna do that again this week on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And then I go through the same thing with what didn't go well and what they would like to see done differently. And I can't try everything new, right? But I will say, you know, I saw this one feedback, I'm gonna really work on this, and I'd love your feedback for next week about how that goes. And so it's a tangible thing that they see every week that I'm trying these new things. And if I can't do it, like no homework, for example, mm-hmm. I'll explain my rationale, and it provides me an opportunity to state my opinion, but also listen to why they don't want any homework, mm-hmm. example. Mm-hmm. But, and so for me, I'm not gonna hear things I wanna hear all the time. I'm just not gonna mm-hmm. feel great. I'm not always on the ball, but like it's for me, if I really want to be there for my students and be responsive to their needs, I need to hear those needs. I need to feel those needs, and then I need to change most importantly. So for me, it's always the feedback that also goes with my curriculum. So when I was a teacher, every year I would say, here are the 7 units we did. Let's vote on if should I teach this one again. And we go one by one. Mm-hmm. And if a unit does not pass by 80%, like 80% of all my students say, yes, teach that unit again, I don't teach that unit again. I scrap mm-hmm. it and I do a different one. And it took me until for 9 years of teaching before I got a fully perfect again. But like, so I just think like really being responsive, having people come in. I'm constantly inviting people to come watch me teach, come into my classroom, give me feedback. Mm-hmm. That's how I grow, is by having people do that. Having somebody come in and observe me twice a year is not going to make me a better teacher. So right. Inviting feedback, inviting people, helping me to grow, encouraging, taking that learning and listening stance always has been the way that I've really been responsive to students' values and needs.
Thank you. There's a question in the chat from Sally who asks about how maybe you modify that feedback cycle when you've got tons of kids. You know, I mean, I'm sure when I taught, I always had 180. I'm sure you had hundreds. How do you collect feedback when you've got that many students?
Yes, when you look at the Google form, I do representative responses. So students tend to say similarly chunked things. So I'll pick like, these are 4 representative responses of all the ones that I got. And like I said, there's no way you can address all of the things and their needs that they want. But the more you get feedback, the more, the less you'll get over time, right? Because as you're being responsive, it's not as overwhelming by the end, because they're like, you're doing good with Snowball. So I think that it's okay to just to kind of say, in summary, here are the main things that people would like more of or really mm-hmm. liked, and we're going to try this again this way, and we're going to try something new in this way this week. And then it's a really good way to improve your practice, but also mm-hmm. it's a really great way to connect with your students.
Agreed. And you're not going to make everybody happy every day, but every child should be seen and heard at least once or twice a day. Every child. Great. Thank you.
I really want to thank Jess and Amy and Margaret again for being our guest, especially on this inaugural episode of Teaching to Meet the Moment. But that's really it for episode 1. And next week, we'll see you here again for episode 2, which we're going to call Community as Possible. In the meantime, please use the hashtag T2MTM, Teaching to Meet the Moment. And Nicole, is there anything you want to say before we sign off?
I'd just like to offer one takeaway, a practical takeaway, in addition to the idea of getting really clear and spending some time reflecting on your values, allowing our kids to take some time and reflect on their values. And I think it was Margaret who said using those values as a touch point to make decisions. Thank you to everybody. And I really look forward to seeing you back same time next week when we talk about community in distance learning, and also community among our colleagues, because we need that more than ever. Thank you, everybody.